Today at Reader's Corner, Edward H. Miller, author of A Conspiratorial Life, Robert Welsh, The John Birch Society, and The Revolution of American Conservatism. I'm Bob Custrow. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Though you may not know his name, Robert Welsh, founder of the John Birch Society, is easily one of the most significant architects of our current political moment. In A Conspiratorial Life, the first full-scale biography of Welsh, Edward H. Miller delves deeply into the life of an overlooked figure whose ideas nevertheless reshaped the American right and planted some of modern conservatism's ideas and beliefs. Edward H. Miller is associate teaching professor at Northeastern University. Both A Conspiratorial Life and his previous book, Nut Country, Right-Wing Dallas and the Birth of the Southern Strategy, were published by the University of Chicago Press. Edward Miller, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So let's start with the very basics here. Tell me about this John Birch Society. I'm sure there are people out there listening who may have come along a little bit later in life to know the John Birch Society as I knew it in my early days in politics. But please share with us just what's this all about.
Well, the John Birch Society was the most successful anti-communist organization in the history of the United States. It was established by Robert Welsh at the home of Margaret Dyce, who was the head of the Daughters of the American Revolution. He established it in 1958. Over a weekend, many titans of business came, including William J. Greedy, former NAM president, that's the National Association of Manufacturers. There was Lawrence Baker, who was a former aide to Douglas MacArthur. There was T. Coleman Andrews, who was a former IRS commissioner, who actually opposed the income tax. There was Fred Koch, who was another NAM leader, who would go on and he was the president of the Rock Island Oil and Refining Company, which later became Koch Industries. So these men had long believed that socialism threatened the body politic. Lenin's vision to seize the world, they believed, was to be achieved by means of the growth of the federal government. And this coterie believed that the communists were perpetrating violence and chaos, and that only common sense and smaller government could break the liberal consensus and produce a better world. The men were very loyal to Robert Welsh. They revered his felicity with words, his articulation of a conspiracy. Most believed his assertion that the communists were controlling or on the verge of controlling the world. So across 2 days, December 8th and 9th, 1958, Robert spoke for a total of 17 hours at the Dyce residence, and he offered 10 predictions of the future. He said there would be expanded government spending, higher taxes, unbalanced budgets, wild inflation, greatly increased socialistic controls, and centralization of power in Washington. It wasn't a secret society like the Ku Klux Klan. It was rather an anonymous society.
He wasn't all wrong either. Listening to some of those you just mentioned, we're living with him now for very different reasons than what Robert Welsh thought, of course.
Well, it's not conspiracy, but some of these were unintended consequences of things. Not conspiracy, I believe, anyway. So there were aspects of the society that mirrored the tactics of the communists, which they pursued in the 1930s. They would use organized fronts to spearhead political causes. They would lead letter writing campaigns with monthly bulletins. Reached a highest point of 24,000 members one time. Mm-hmm. They would inform their headquarters in Belmont, Massachusetts, of local chapter activity throughout the nation, much in the spirit of the colonial committees of correspondence. Mm-hmm. Early joiners were urged by Welsh to read conservative books, dedicate their time in local libraries to study the communist conspiracy. They would hear lectures. They would discuss the contents of the monthly bulletin at home, in the barber shop, in the hair salon, or in the bait shop. They would read and share the JBS magazine American Opinion. So when Welch got back from Indianapolis, he gave the same speech many times around the greater Boston area. And the first six chapters all began in Massachusetts, where I'm from. And then he hit the road to deliver that founding speech throughout the country. And he gave it 80 times over the next 3 years. And the JBS grew exponentially. The society grew fast in California, Texas, other Sunbelt states. It was mostly white, middle-class members. Soon there were chapters all over the country. And it was a real feasible national anti-communist organization.
How did John Birch get into it? Who is he and why would they name this organization after him?
Oh, that's a great question. So John Birch is a Baptist missionary killed by the Chinese communists about 10 days after the end of World War II. See, the right was suffering from all these difficult times in 1954. McCarthy was fired by Truman.
MacArthur was fired by Truman.
MacArthur was fired by Truman. Yeah. McCarthy was failing due to alcoholism. So Welch is working on this book, The Life of John Birch. And this new narrative that Welch is peddling is a conspiratorial thesis addressing who lost China. And at the center of it was John Birch. For Welch, Birch offered the evidence of a massive conspiracy and a cover-up centered on the loss of China and treason by high-level American officials. He said that Birch was the first casualty of the Cold War. He's born to missionary parents in India. He's a disciple of J. Frank Norris. Welch saw a younger version of himself in John Birch. They were both from the South. They both had absolutist temperaments. They both shared a zealous belief that America's role in China was ordained by God. And then Birch shipped out to China to evangelize. And in August 1945, Birch encountered Chinese communist soldiers. He was ordered to disarm, never one to back down. He didn't, and he was shot dead. And Welch presented him in the book as a victim of two conspiracies. The first was calculated murder by the Chinese Communist Party. The second was the cover-up by the State Department, which Welch alleged sought to keep the sellout of China under wraps. The deep state was complicit, said Welch. Had Birch lived, wrote Welch, the world would be very different now. Chiang would have defeated Mao. China would be a democratic republic. Welch believed that every American needed to know Birch's story. The survival of Western civilization was all that was at stake.
You know, I have to ask you at this stage, I'm listening to that word deep state, and it's hard not to think of some of the accusations and the conspiracies we live with today. And I believe at one point in your book, you actually talk about Robert Welch's world is our world today. Do any of these groups that we hear of today, right-wing, conspiratorial, do we have evidence that they actually go back to the intellectual foundations of Robert Welch?
Well, it was never my intention to argue that they derive directly from the individuals of the John Birch Society. My argument in the book was that the ideas of the John Birch Society continued
right
in other organizations. Like take the National Rifle Association, which was primarily designed for self-defense early on. It was the John Birch Society that argued your Second Amendment rights are in jeopardy because of the government. Now the National Rifle Association is saying that same thing. When we hear senators, United States senators saying that we live in a republic, not a democracy, that's directly from the billboards of the John Birch Society, in which say we live in a republic, not a democracy. And obviously it was an effort to oppose the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, any of the any of the efforts to expand the franchise. We can take a look at the PTAs. We call them school committees here in Massachusetts, but Robert Welch said, get involved in the PTAs, take over your PTAs. And we're seeing that throughout the country right now, not necessarily by Birch Society members, but folks who are concerned about what's going on in the schools. And Welch was very much concerned about what was going on in the schools. He was concerned about the rise of communism in the schools. And E. Merrill Root wrote a book in the 1950s called Brainwashing in the High Schools, and another book about colleges, the collectivization on campuses. So he was very much ahead of these issues. Also, take a look at the fluoride issue, which the John Birch Society opposed. They opposed the fluoride in drinking water. I always suppose that was the case because they had so many dentists on the John Birch Society, but the vaccination conspiracies and these foolish canards about the safety of vaccination, which has taken off across the United States, is not unlike the fluoride issue.
I want to ask you a question about how Welch's work, how the work of the John Birch Society fits into the Christian movements at the time. And to do so, I'm going to start with a little bit of my background. When I was in high school, I had a Catholic nun in my senior class take the entire class down to one of St. Louis's major movie theaters, where Frederick Schwartz and his Christian anti-communist crusade, which shows up in your book in three or four places, by name anyway, delivered this scary presentation. I can still remember the red-colored map showing all the countries that either were communist or were about to be communist. And it never occurred to me until I read your book when I started wondering, this whole conspiracy theory of Welch's, especially the anti-communist aspects of it. There were a lot of other things he did that you can talk about later, but it seems to fit right in to what the Christian movement was all about in those days as well.
And especially the Catholic movement, because it was Cardinal Cushing who early on backed to the John Birch Society before he came to realize that it was a little bit more radical than he supposed. But about 50% of members were Catholic in the John Birch Society. It was coming out of a state, Massachusetts, that was highly Catholic. And there was a significant amount of support in other states among Catholics. Robert Welch, though, was born a Baptist, and he died a Unitarian. There was a report that he wrote. It was called the Reamer Report, in which he basically said that he was not a fundamentalist. This Reamer Report was successful in allowing other people of diverse faiths, including Baptist faiths such as Tim LaHaye, to join the John Birch Society. Tim LaHaye appeared in some of the John Birch Society films, and that was unlike Tim LaHaye. He always said that he would only join organizations that were religious organizations, but Welch had a close association with McCarthy, who is a Catholic, and began to echo a lot of the claims that McCarthy made, such as the argument that folks in the army were communists. In fact, I would argue that Welch went one step further, and whereas McCarthy called the army communist, Welch went further and said the head of the army Dwight David Eisenhower is a communist.
Well, let's stop there because I want to talk about the Eisenhower letter. But first, I want to remind our listeners that you are listening to Edward H. Miller. He's the author of A Conspiratorial Life, Robert Welsh, The John Birch Society, and The Revolution of American Conservatism. So let's talk about the Eisenhower letter, and specifically the book, I think, which emanated from the letter called The Politician. That may have been Welsh's only book, but how does that have implications for the fate of American conservatism, even in the 21st century, as you say in your book?
Well, I'll just give a little bit more background. In 1954, Welsh was on a car ride with Howard Pugh, and he began to make some ridiculous statements to the effect that Dwight Eisenhower was a communist. It surprised one of his listeners so much that he said, the listener said, "Can you please put that in writing?" And Welsh began the process of putting it into writing. And soon that short essay became 200 pages. And according to Welsh, the people wanted to get their hands on this private letter. And it began really a controversy, the biggest controversy in the life of Robert Welsh and in the history of the John Birch Society, because he sent one of the letters to William F. Buckley, who was reluctant to believe it. Buckley never believed that domestic communists, as opposed to foreign ones, were a greater threat to America's survival. He saw as problematic to the conservative movement that Welsh was a conspiracist, and Buckley feared that it would make the right appear as if it was cracking up. So Buckley just disagreed with the hypothesis that Eisenhower was a communist, and he basically said, you're being a little bit too optimistic because things are going to get worse, Buckley said, when Eisenhower leaves. But it's the crossroads of the movement. Do we go this way, Buckley's? Which is a respectable form of conservatism, or do we go towards a less respectable Welchian conservatism? Now look at us today. Who is influencing conservatism today? I would suggest that Welch has the upper hand. Mm-hmm. Look at the wild-eyed conspiracies in Republican politics, the birther conspiracy. The day Joe Biden took office, Donald J. Trump still had not conceded. He still has not conceded the 2020 election. The QAnon conspiracy theory, a ridiculous conspiracy theory that holds that Democrats in the deep state undermined Trump's presidency in order to cover up their child sex racket, and claims Marjorie Taylor Greene among its adherents is viewed favorably by one third of Republicans. So my point is to say, despite this predominant story, that the suave, almost responsible right of Buckley purged the conservative movement and saved it, Welsh was never excommunicated, and his style of American conservatism remains extremely potent.
Yeah, let's talk about one other example. Speaking of Eisenhower, I read in one of those cut lines beneath the photos in your book that Welsh thought the primary election of 1952 that nominated Eisenhower over Senator Robert Taft, who Welsh was supporting, was rigged. I saw that word rigged, I thought, hey, now we're really moving back or into the 21st century. How did that happen?
Well, and I'll go on further. Phyllis Schlafly believed the same thing, that it was rigged. Yeah. And she says so in her book, A Choice, Not an Echo. Welsh wanted for Taft to win. Eisenhower worried about Taft's hesitancy toward NATO. He blanched at the thought of seeing him in the Oval Office. Taft's NATO policy risked the post-war peace, Ike thought, and he felt an obligation to run. And he did run. He decided to run. The United States had just fought a war to establish collective security. Taft didn't believe in collective security. So Eisenhower had concluded that he was going to run. Senator Henry Cabot Lodge Jr. had the same opinion of Taft. And he spoke with Ike about the need to stop Taft. So Governor Dewey came on board. Lodge's appointed campaign manager, and suddenly Ike was running for president. Now, Welch didn't think that Eisenhower could win the nomination, but he was wrong. The issues of the day gave Welch a lot of confidence in Taft. The American people were preoccupied with China, spies in government, the growth of the state. These are the issues that Taft had led the way on. A lot of the papers, including the McCormick papers, the Wall Street Journal, all backed Taft. But Eisenhower began mollifying the old guard, and he used John Foster Dulles to show his support for liberation in Eastern Europe. And then the efforts at the convention began. Ike displayed his unalloyed ruthlessness on the eve of the convention when Taft had 530 delegates and Eisenhower only had 427. Taft had the Southern delegations locked down, just as his father had in 1912 against Theodore Roosevelt. Then Lodge, just as his father had done, demonstrated his mastery of parliamentary procedure. Lodge was a steamroller, intimidating undecided delegates, successfully challenging the credentials of Taft delegations from Texas, Georgia, and Louisiana. Eisenhower got the nomination on the first ballot. Welch cried foul. It was rigged. And here we are, back to the future. Right.
So Eisenhower wasn't the only Republican that Welch didn't trust or support. He refused, according to your book, to call President Reagan a conservative. Tell us about that.
Well, on the basis of the 1967 Abortion Act, which liberalized the abortion law in California when Reagan was governor, Welch concluded that Ronald Reagan was not a conservative. And Welch was also unhappy that Reagan did not include Birchers within his administration. He felt as if he could take some more rank and file members and bring them to Sacramento. So he concluded that Ronald Reagan was a pseudo conservative, and he supported Wallace in 1968. Welch did.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Edward H. Miller, author of A Conspiratorial Life, Robert Welch, the John Birch Society, and the Revolution of American Conservatism. So let's talk a little bit about the Kennedy administration, and especially Kennedy's assassination, because it seems that at that moment you see some of the seeds of opposition. The people start questioning this Birch Society and Robert Welch as agents of extremism. Is that about the time that you could really verify the Birch Society running into some real difficult issues with the more standard Republicans?
For a brief period, they would make a huge comeback in the 1970s as the situation in the United States became more precarious. But at 12:30 on November 22nd, 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy, and in Phoenix, two shots were fired into the local office of the John Birch Society. One, somebody yelled, "You killed my man," on the phone. At that time, the national press was presenting the JBS as dangerous extremists. And many people came to the conclusion that the organization had something to do with the assassination. That was wrong, because Lee Harvey Oswald was a communist and not ideologically in line with the John Birch Society. But Welch received threatening phone calls. There were shouting college-age youngsters circling the John Birch Society in Belmont. They were yelling insults and catcalls. Somebody threw a brick through the office window. And it impacted not only the John Birch Society, but the far right. John Tower had to hole up his family outside of Texas. Richard Nixon went on the phone with Hoover and said, "What happened? Was it one of the right-wing nuts?" So Welch is trying to temper some of this animosity towards the John Birch Society with a full-page advertisement in the New York Times saying communism killed Kennedy. But it's really to no avail, because many blame the right, despite the fact that a communist killed the president. And so the assassination itself really reinforced the idea that the radical right and the John Birch Society were agents of extremism, and it casts a long shadow over the Goldwater campaign. There was a study done by one of the Goldwater campaign's chief consultants, Peter O'Donnell, conducted a month before the assassination, determining whether Republicans or Democrats were associated with the radical right. And it was found a month before the assassination, there was no association. But after the assassination, extremism was a problem for the Republicans. So Goldwater came to be seen as a trigger-happy warmonger and a danger to the country.
So what is the status of the John Birch Society today when you compare it to what your book covered over the many years of Robert Welch's life and after? Is it still an organization that's making a difference in conservative circles, conservative thinking?
Well, that is a great question. And remember, I finished this book in November of 2021. And I have since heard reports that the John Birch Society is experiencing a renaissance in, among all places, Idaho, and experiencing a comeback in Texas. There was a report that in Texas, a chapter of the John Birch Society was being founded in Fort Worth. You know, my intention in this book was to argue that it was the ideas of the John Birch Society that were adopted by other groups. But since I finished the book, and it's probably too early to make any ultimate conclusions based on a couple incidents here and there, but it seems to suggest that there are some folks who are moving towards that direction.
Mm-hmm. Is there any difference between what the John Birch Society stood for in the years your book covered it compared to what the John Birch Society might be doing today? I'm thinking of January 6th and what compelled those folks to show up that day at the Capitol.
Well, I think I'm going to have to punt on that question because as an historian, I like to give myself at least 50 years
right.
Of at least 50 years to try to understand a period.
Yeah.
And even though I live in 2022, as we all do, analyzing, I'm not an analyst of the contemporary situation with the John Birch Society, and I don't really know much about its contemporary beliefs. I wrote this book, and it finishes in 1985, the year of Robert Welch's death. And I could only comment on some of the ideas as they were expressed within other organizations.
Well, there certainly seems to be significant similarities between the thoughts and agendas of those we're hearing about today and those that you have documented in your book. It's a very timely book. I mean, this is something that as you read this, first of all, I must say you did a great job covering the history of the period. Yes, it's about Robert Welch. Yes, it's about the John Birch Society. But I was frankly impressed with how many things I read that I really hadn't drilled down in my American history courses in those days years ago. And so your book is a great way to get an insider's look at the 1950s, 60s, and right up till 85, as you say.
Well, thank you very much. I deeply appreciate that.
Yeah, well, I want to close on that and, again, suggest to our listeners the name of this book, and it'd be a good read, is A Conspiratorial Life by Edward H. Miller, Robert Welch, the John Birch Society, and the Revolution of American Conservatism. Edward Miller, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Oh, it was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.